urging them forward at a slow walk. The preacher-looking man took an angling course, making for the road edge, turning his horse so that its body would hide the short Spencer carbine in its scabbard at his knee. His companions stopped in a group before the old man. There was a quick movement, and someone let out a high-pitched scream. The old man had produced his gun from behind him and had, in one swift motion, poked it up under the soft of one big man's chin and then pulled it back. It was a fowling piece of antique design. The hammer was cocked, and the bore to it was as big around as a shot glass. A little runnel of blood went down the big man's neck and disappeared into his shirt collar. The other big man and the white-headed boy sat and looked off across a little bit of cornfield, where an old gray stook of last year's fodder formed a sagging cone at the edge of the woods. They smiled, as if they might have been expecting something of modest drollness to appear among the trees. The old man said, "You, by the fence. I know who you are. You're Teague. Get over here." Teague did not move. The old man said, "You not coming?" Teague sat his ground. He had a grin on his face, but his eyes looked like a cold fireplace with the ashes shoveled out. "These your big niggers?" the old man said to Teague. "I don't know that's what they are," Teague said. "But they're not mine. You couldn't give me that pair free." "Whose then?" the old man said. "Their own, I reckon," Teague said. "You get on over here with us," the man said. "I'll just rest here at the edge of the woods," Teague said. "You're making me jumpy, and I'm fixing to put a load in somebody," the man said. "You just got the one barrel," Teague pointed out. "This gun's right comprehensive when you let fly with it," the man said. He took several steps backward until he judged the three men before him were all compassed by the wide shot pattern the big gun threw. Then he said, "Get down off them horses and stand in a bunch." Everyone but Teague dismounted. The horses stood with their reins dragging the ground, their ears forward, like they were enjoying themselves. The man with the wound, Byron by name, put his fingers to it and looked at the blood and then wiped his hands on his loose shirt tail. The other one, name of Iron, held his head cocked up to the side, and a pink tip of tongue showed at his mouth, so careful was he now attending to every detail of the current scene. The white-headed boy rubbed his blue eyes and pulled in several directions at his clothing, as if he had just woken up from sleeping in them. Then he stood and examined with great fascination the nail to his left index finger. It was near as long as the finger itself, the way some people will grow them for cutting butter and dipping lard and other such tasks. The old man stood with the shotgun covering the three of them and surveyed their various armature. "What do them niggers use their long cavalry sabers for? Hold meat over a fire to roast?" he asked Teague. There was a long moment of silence. Then the old man said, "What are you up here after?" "You know," Teague said, "catch up outliers." "They're all gone," the old man said, "long since, laying out in the woods where they'll be hard to find, or passed on over the mountains to cross the lines and oath allegiance." "Oh," said Teague, "if I take your point, we best just go back to town then, is that what you're saying?" "Save us all trouble if you do," the man said. "You don't watch out, we're liable to hang your old ass too," Teague said. "They were gone, you wouldn't be meeting us in the road armed." At that moment the white-headed boy fell prone in the dirt and yelled out, "King of Kings." The first instant that the old man's attention collected on the boy, Iron lunged with a grace unexpected in one of so much size, and struck the man a clubbing blow to the head with his left fist. He followed that with a slap to the hand, knocking the shotgun away. The old man fell on his back, his hat in the dirt, beside him. Iron stepped over and picked up the shotgun and beat the old man with it until the stock broke off, and then he beat him with just the barrel. After a time the man lay still on the road. He was somewhat conscious, but had a puzzled look in his eyes. Something ran from one ear that had all the features of red-eye gravy. Byron spit at the ground and wiped away the blood on his head, and then he drew his saber and put the point of it under the old man's lapped chin and pressed until he caused a runnel of blood equal to his own. "Hold meat over a fire," he said. "Leave him be," Iron said. "There's no harm left in him." Both men, despite their size, had little keen voices pitched high as bird song. Byron took the sword from the man's chin, but then, before anyone could make out his intentions, he took the haft in both hands, and in a motion that looked no more effortful than plunging the dasher into a butter churn, he skewered the old man through the stomach. Byron stepped away with his hands held out open to either side. There was nothing to see of the sword blade, just the scrolled guard and wire-wrapped grip sticking from beneath the old man's chest. He tried to rise, but only his head and knees came up, for he was spiked to the ground. Byron looked at Teague and said, "You want me to finish him?" "Just let him fight it out with his maker," said Teague. The boy rose from where he still lay on the ground, and he went and stood over the man and gawped at him. "He's ready for death," the boy said. "His lamp is burning, and he waits for the bridegroom." They all laughed except for the old man and Teague. Teague said, "Shut up, Birch. Let's move." They mounted to ride to the house, and as they did, the old man breathed his last and died with a wail. In passing, Byron leaned low from his saddle, agile as a trick rider in a tent show, and drew out the saber and wiped it on the mane of his horse before returning it to its scabbard. Byron went to the gate and kicked it open to break the latch, and they rode through it and right up to the porch. "Come on out," Teague called. There was a note of festive to his voice. When no one appeared, Teague looked at Byron and Iron and tipped his chin at the front door. The two dismounted and looped their reins around porch posts and set about making circuits of the house in opposite directions, pistols drawn. They moved as a partnership of wolves will hunt, in wordless coordination of effort toward a shared purpose. They were naturally quick, and their movements were easy and fluent, despite their being so bulky. But in a clinch was where their main advantage was, for between the two of them they looked to be about able to dismember a man with their hands. After they had orbited the empty house three times, they burst through the front and back doors at the same instant. In a minute they came out, Iron with a fistful of tapers paired by their wicks, and Byron carrying part of a ham which he held by the shank of its white bone like a chicken leg. They put them in panniers on the horses. Then, without word or gesture of command or even suggestion, Teague and Birch climbed down to earth from their mounts, and they all walked to the barn, where they threw open the doors to the stalls. They found but one old mule inside. They trod about among the hay in the loft and ran their sabers into the deepest piles, and then they came out and turned their attention to the fodder crib. But as they approached it, the door sprung open, and the three outliers broke to run. The men were hindered in their escape, for they carried improvised weapons that had the look of artifacts from a yet darker age. A sharpened plow point swinging at the end of a chain, an old spade beaten and filed into the semblance of a spear, a pine-knot cudgel spiked at its head with horseshoe nails. Teague let the men run a ways, and then he put the carbine to his shoulder and shot down the two front runners, who fell with a great clatter of weaponry. The last man, the captive, stopped and raised his hands and faced them. Teague looked at him a minute. The man went bootless that day, and he dug his toes at the dirt as if looking for a better hold. Teague licked his thumb and wiped it on the foreside of his spencer and raised the carbine and fit bead to notch. The man stood there motionless. He kept his grip on the spiked cudgel so that he stood with it raised over his head, as savages are depicted in book plates. Teague lowered the carbine and put the butt of it on the ground and held it loose in one hand by the barrel. "Throw that stick down, or I'm sending these two over to pull you apart," he said. The captive looked at the two big men and then dropped the pine knot at his feet. "Good," Teague said. "Now just stand there." The men all walked over to the captive, and Iron grabbed him by the neck and snatched him up like a pup by the scruff. They then turned their attention toward the two men on the ground. One was dead and had hardly bled enough to stain his clothes. The other had taken a bullet to the bowels. He yet lived, but barely. He was propped up on his elbows, and he pulled his breeches and drawers down about his knees. He probed his wound with a pair of fingers, and then looked at them and hollered, "I'm kilt." The guard came and stood around him, but when they smelled the tang in the air, they backed off. The captive squirmed like he wanted to go to his downed friend, and Iron hit him in the side of the head three flat blows with the meat of his fist heel. Birch took out a black twist of chaw and gripped one end between his teeth, and took his knife and sawed it off at his lips, and put the remainder in his pocket. When he spit, he scuffed dirt with his boot toe over the amber spot, as if fastidious about marking the ground, heedful of leaving sign. The shot man lay back flat and blinked at the sky and seemed baffled by it. His mouth formed words, but he made no sound beyond the clickings of a dry mouth. Then his eyes closed, and for some time he might have been thought dead, except that at wide intervals he worked his fingers. He bled beyond all reason. The grass around him was matted red, and his clothes hung heavy and slick like oilcloth. Even in the dim light, it looked bright. Then the blood quit coming, and he opened his eyes again without any effort toward focus. They guessed he had died. Birch offered to go spit juice in his eye to see would he blink, but Teague said, "We don't need to test him. He's passed." "This one's preceded you in death like your old daddy," Birch said to the captive. The man said nothing, and Teague said, "Birch, hush. Get me something to tie his hands, and then we'll lead him back to town on the end of a line." The boy went to the horses and came back with a coil of rope. But when Teague bent to tie his hands, the captive lost his mind. There was no accounting for his actions, other than that he would rather die than be bound. He kicked out in fright, fetching Teague a glancing blow to the thigh. So Teague and the big men fought him, and the man was so wild that for a time it was unclear who would prevail. He struck at them with every limb he had and butted with his head as well. He screamed the whole time, a high, warbling scream that near to unnerved them all. But finally they threw him to the ground and lashed his wrists and ankles together. Even then he bucked and strained and reached with his head until he bit Teague on the hand, drawing blood. Teague wiped his hand on a coat tail and looked at it. "I'd rather take a hog bite than a man," he said. He sent Birch back to the house for a straight chair. Then they all worked at tying the man into it, binding him down with his arms to his sides and looping rope about his neck until he could do little but wiggle his fingers and twist his head about in the way turtles will do when flipped onto their backs. "There," Teague said. "Like to see him bite me now." "Berserk," Birch said. "I've read about it. It's a word for a thing people can go." They paused and squatted and caught their breaths, and the man strained against the ropes until his neck bled, and then he fell quiet. Byron and Iron rested with their forearms on their massy thighs. Teague sucked at his wound and then took out a kerchief and brushed the dirt from his black coat and wiped at the toe marks the man had left on the thigh of his pale pants. Birch held up his left hand and saw that in the struggle he had torn his long fingernail halfway across. He took out his knife and pared it away, cursing all the while at his loss. Iron said, "We could take that little drag sled there and set him up in it and ride him into town harnessed to that chair." "Could," Teague said, "but I'm leaning right now toward carrying him up to the barn loft and roping his neck to a rafter and shoving him out the hay door." "You can't hang a man a-sittin'," Birch said. "Can't," Teague said. "I'd like to know why not. Hell, I've seen it done." "Well, still, it'd look better if we brought somebody in now and then," Birch said. The men stood and conferred, and they evidently saw the reason in Birch's thinking, for they gathered around the chair and lifted it and carried it to the sled. They tied the chair to the sled and harnessed it to the mule and set off for town, the man's head jouncing, for he had no will to even hold it level. "This world won't stand long," the captive hollered in conclusion to his tale. "God won't let it stand this way long." By the time he was done talking, the sun had fallen well to the west, and Ada and Ruby turned from the courthouse and started walking home. They were both grim and initially wordless, and then later along the way they discussed the captive's story. Ada wanted to cast it as an exaggeration, but Ruby's conclusion was that it ought to be viewed as truth, since it sorted so well with the capabilities of men. Then they argued generally for a mile or two as to whether the world might better be viewed as such a place of threat and fear that the only consonant attitude one could maintain was gloom, or whether one should strive for light and cheer, even though a dark-fisted hand seemed poised, ready to strike at any moment. When they reached the west fork of the Pigeon and turned up the river road, the light was growing thin, and a shadow already draped itself over the knob called Big Stomp, cast by the larger mountains of the Blue Ridge. The water looked black and cold, and the smell of river hung in the air, about equal parts mineral and vegetable. Though the river had fallen some since morning, it was still up from the last night's rain, and the rocks out in it were wet and dark, where trees from either bank nearly met in the middle and kept the watercourse shaded all day. They had not walked far above the fork when Ruby stopped and squared her body to the water, sighting on something in it as if to take range. She sank down in her knees just a notch, like a fighter lowering his center of gravity to compose himself for attack. She said, "Well, look there, that's not a common sight." Off in the river stood a great blue heron. It was a tall bird to begin with, but something about the angle from which they viewed it and the cast of low sun made it seem even taller. It looked high as a man in the slant light, with its long shadow blown out across the water. Its legs and the tips of its wings were black as the river. The beak of it was black on top and yellow underneath, and the light shone off it with muted sheen as from satin or chipped flint. The heron stared down into the water with fierce concentration. At wide intervals it took delicate, slow steps, lifting a foot from out the water and pausing, as if waiting for it to quit dripping, and then placing it back on the river bottom in a new spot, apparently chosen only after deep reflection. Ruby said, "He's looking for a frog or a fish." But his staring so heedfully into the water reminded Ada of Narcissus, and to further their continuing studies of the Greeks, she told Ruby a brief version of the tale. "Well, that bird's not thinking about himself at all," Ruby said when Ada had finished the story. "Look at that beak on him. Stab wounds, that's his main nature. He's thinking about what other thing he can stab and eat." They stepped slowly toward the river edge, and the heron turned to look at them with some interest. He made tiny, precise adjustments of his narrow head, as if having trouble sighting around his blade of beak. His eyes seemed to Ada to be searching for her merits and coming up short. "What are you doing up here?" she said aloud to the heron. But she knew by the look of him that his nature was anchorite and mystic. Like all of his kind, he was a solitary pilgrim, strange in his ways, and governed by no policy or creed common to flocking birds. Ada wondered that herons could tolerate each other close enough to breed. She had seen a scant number in her life, and those so lonesome as to make the heart sting on their behalf. Exile birds, everywhere they were, seemed far from home. The heron walked toward them to the river edge and stood on a welt of mud. He was not 10 feet away. He tipped his head a notch off level, raised a black leg, scales as big as fingernails, the foot held just off the ground. Ada stared down at the strange footprint in the mud. When she looked up, the bird was staring at her, as at someone met long ago, dimly registered in memory. Then the heron slowly opened its wings. The process was carried out as if it were a matter of hinges and levers, cranks and pulleys. All the long bones under the feathers and skin were much in evidence. When it was done, the wings were so broad that Ada could not imagine how it would get out among the trees. The bird took a step toward Ada, lifted itself from the ground, and with only a slow beat or two of the immense wings, soared just above her head and up and away through the forest canopy. Ada felt the sweep of wings, the stir of air, a cold blue shadow across the ground, across the skin of her face. She wheeled and watched until the heron was gone into the sky. She threw up a hand like waving bye to visiting kin. What would that be, she wondered? A blessing? A warning beacon? Picket of the spirit world? Ada took out her new journal and whittled one of the charcoal pencils to a point with her penknife. She made a quick, loose-lined memory sketch of the heron as it had stood in the mud. When she was done, she was dissatisfied with the curve of the neck and the angle of the beak, but she had the legs and the ruff of feathers at his crop and the look in his eye just right. Across the bottom of the page, in her runic hand, she wrote, "Blue Heron, Forks of the Pigeon, 9 October, 1864. She looked up at the sky and then said to Ruby, "What time would you guess it to be?" Ruby cocked an eye to the west and said, "A little after 5, and Ada wrote down 5 o'clock and closed the journal. As they walked on up the river, they talked to the bird, and Ruby revealed what she felt to be her snaggy relationship with herons. Sobrod, she said, had often during her childhood disclaimed her, saying she had no man-father. Her mother, during her pregnancy with Ruby, when drunk and embittered and wishing to get a rise out of him, had often charged that Stobrod had no part in the baby, and that its cause was a tall blue heron. She claimed it had lit at the creek one morning, and after spending the forenoon spearing crawfish, had come into the yard where she was breaking apart a crust of old cornbread and scattering it on the ground for the chickens. The tale Ruby's mother told, as recounted by Stobrod, was that the heron strode up on its long, back-hinged legs and looked her eye to eye. She claimed, Stobrod said, that the look was unmistakable, not open to but one interpretation. She turned and ran, but the heron chased her into the house, where, as she hunkered on hands and knees, trying to squeeze under the bedstead to hide, the heron came upon her from behind. She described what ensued as like a flogging of dreadful scope. "He told me that story 100 times, Ruby said. "I mostly know it to be one of his lies, but I still can't look on one of those birds without wondering." Ada did not know what to say. The light under the trees by the river had fallen to gold, and the leaves on beech and poplar shivered in a small wind. Ruby stopped and put on her sweater, and Ada shook the wrinkles out of her coat and draped it over her shoulders like a cloak. They walked on, and at the fork of the river they met a young woman carrying a baby wrapped in a checked tablecloth slung over her shoulder. She skipped barefoot across the stepping stones as graceful as a deer running, and said not a word, nor even met their eyes when she passed, though the baby stared at them, expressionless, from eyes as brown as acorn caps set in his head. Soon after the ford, small birds flew from an apple tree standing alone in an old field. They flew close to the ground and entered the woods. The setting sun was in Ruby's eyes, so that she could only make a guess at their kind, but for weather purposes it did not matter. The thing their pattern of flying told was more rain. Yet further up the road, near a hole in the river where people were sometimes dipped in baptism, a cloud of martins erupted out of a maple tree, nearing the peak of its color. The sun's bottom limb was just touching the ridge, and the sky was the color of hammered pewter. The martins flew from the tree as one body, still in the shape of the round maple they had filled. Then they banked into the wind, slipped sideways in the moving air on extended wings for two heartbeats, so that Ada viewed them in thin profile, and saw much silver space between the individual birds. Immediately, as if on signal, they swept into a steep climb, and the fullness of their wings turned toward her and closed the bright gaps between the birds, so that the flock looked like the black image of the red maple projected into the sky. The bird shadows across the long field grass beyond the road flickered. Twilight rose up around Ada and Ruby as if the dark from the river were seeping skyward. Ruby's fanciful heron story of source and root reminded Ada of a story Monroe had told not long before his death. It concerned the manner in which he had wooed her mother, and past the darkening miles upriver, Ada recounted it in some detail to Ruby. Ada had known that Monroe and her mother had married relatively late in life, he at 45, she at 36, and Ada knew their time together had been brief. But she did not know the circumstances of their courtship and marriage, assuming it an alliance of calm friendship, the sort of tie she had seen formed numerous times between peculiar old bachelors and aging spinsters. She supposed herself to be a product of some sad miscalculation. That is, until one afternoon in the winter before Monroe's death. A wet snow had fallen all day, the large flakes melting as they struck the ground. Ada Monroe sat by the fire through the long afternoon, Ada reading to him from a new book, The Conduct of Life. Monroe had for many years followed Mr. Emerson's every published utterance with keen interest, and that day he thought Emerson, as always, even in old age, perhaps one degree more extreme in his spiritual views than was called for. As the day drew to a close outside the window as Ada put the book aside, Monroe looked tired, gray, his eyes sunken. He sat studying the fire, which had settled into its ashes and burned slowly, with scarce flame. Eventually, he said, "I have never told you how I came to marry your mother." "No," Ada said. "It is a thing that keeps coming into my mind of late. I don't know why. You've never known that I met your mother when she was barely 16 and I 25. "No," Ada said. "Oh, yes. The first time I saw her, I thought she was the loveliest thing I'd ever seen. It was February, a gray day, chill with a faint damp breeze blowing from off the ocean. I was out riding. I'd then recently bought a great Hanoverian gelding, 17 hands if an inch, a bloodstone chestnut. He was just the slightest bit cowhocked, but not enough to matter. His canter was a thing of wonder, like floating. I'd ridden him some way out of Charleston, north along the Ashley, past Middleton, then over and down to Hanahan on my way back home. It was a long ride. The horse was lathered despite the coolness of the air, and I was hungry and anxious for supper. It was just this time of day, gray night. We were at the first point where you could with confidence say we had left the country and entered the city. We came to a house, one that could be described as neither modest nor grand. It had a broad porch, with old palmettos at either end. It was too near the road for my tastes. Its windows were dark, and it had a water trough in the yard. Thinking no one home, I stopped and dismounted to water my horse. From the porch, a woman's voice came, saying, "You might ask leave first." She had apparently been sitting alone on a bench beneath the windows. I took off my hat and said, "I beg your pardon." She stepped out from the shadow of the porch and walked down the steps and stopped on the bottom one. She wore a winter dress of gray wool, a black shawl about her shoulders, hair the color of a crow's wing. She had been brushing it, for it was down nearly to the small of her back, and she held a brush with a tortoiseshell handle. Her face was pale as marble. There was not a thing about her that was not either black, white, or a shade between the two. Despite her harsh attire, I was totally disarmed. I've never seen the match to her. There is not a word for how beautiful she looked to me. All I could say was, "Again, miss, I beg your pardon." I mounted and rode away, flustered, my thoughts all in a churn. Sometime that night, after I'd taken dinner and gone to bed, it came to me. That was the woman I was meant to marry. The next day, I set about courting her, and I went at it just as hard and as carefully as a man can. First, I collected information. I found that her name was Claire Deschute. Her father, a Frenchman, made a living trading back and forth with his home country, importing wine and exporting rice. He was a man of comfort, if not of great means. I arranged a meeting with him at his warehouse near a dock on the Cooper, a dank and gloomy place that smelled of the river. It was filled with wooden crates of claret, both fine and cheap, and tow sacks of our rice. We were introduced by my friend Aswell, who had done business with Deschute in the past. Deschute, your grandfather, was a short man and heavy, portly would be the term, more French in his ways than I care for, if you take my meaning. Neither you nor your mother shared any observable characteristic with him. I made my intentions clear from the start. I wished to marry his daughter and sought his approval and assistance. I offered to provide him with references, financial statements, anything that might convince him of my desirability as a son-in-law. I could see his mind working. He tugged at his cravat, rolled his eyes. He went off to the side and conferred with Aswell for a time. When he returned, he reached out his hand and said, "May I offer any assistance within my power?" His only sticking point was this. He wished Claire not to marry before her 18th birthday. I agreed. 2 years seemed not too long to wait, and a fair request on his part. Within a few days, he took me home to dinner as his guest. My introduction to your mother was at his hand. I could see in her eyes that she knew me from the night in the yard, but she said not a word of it. I believed from the beginning that my feeling toward her was returned. We courted for months, through the spring and summer and into the autumn. We met at balls, to which I arranged her invitation. I rode north to the Deschute house over and over on the Hanoverian gelding. Claire and I sat on the bench on the broad porch night after night through the humid summer, and talked of every subject dear to our hearts. Days when I could not ride out, we posted letters which crossed paths somewhere on Meeting Street. In the late fall, I had a ring made. It was a blue diamond, a stone as big as the end of your little finger. It was set in a band of white filigreed gold. I made up my mind to present it to her one evening in late November as a surprise. On the chosen date, I rode the Hanoverian out north in the dusk, the ring nestling in a pouch of velvet in my waistcoat pocket. It was a night with a chill in the air, brisk and wintry, at least in Charleston terms, a night alike in its every feature to the one on which we had first met. By the time I reached the Deschute house, the sky was fully dark, but the house was lighted, every window ablaze in welcome. The sound of a piano, Bach, faintly reached me from inside. I sat in the road a moment, thinking the night to be the culmination of the previous season's effort, all my heart's desire within easy reach. Then I heard the low murmur of voices from the porch, saw movement. Claire's profile leaned forward, her black silhouette framed in the yellow light of the window. There was no mistaking it for anyone else's. From the other side of the window leaned another face, a man's. They met and kissed, a long kiss and a passionate one from what I could tell. Their faces parted, and her hand reached to his face and guided it back again. My stomach clenched, and my hands. I longed to step to the porch and shout my outrage and thrash someone. But the humiliating role of the betrayed suitor was not one I relished playing. Without another thought, I put spurs to the horse and sped off north at a feverish pace. We went for miles and miles, that tall horse stretching out long in its gallop. It was like riding in a dream, hurling through a dark world at a rate more akin to winged flight than riding horseback. We passed through dense flats of turkey oak and slash pine and yaw pine, through open barrens of wiregrass and sawgrass, until finally, in a place where wax myrtle thickets hemmed in the road to left and right, the horse slowed and walked, blowing hard, head down. I had no clear idea where I was. I had not kept up with the turnings of the roads or even the fine points of the compass bearing we had been following. Generally north was all I knew, for we had not plunged into either the Ashley or the Cooper and drowned. In the scant light of a partial moon, the sweated chestnut gelding looked black as ebony and as glossy. Other than act fully the wild man and set a course west to lose myself for life in the trackless territories of Texas, there was little to do but turn and head home. As I fixed to do so, however, I saw that ahead of me the sky was lighted up yellow over the wax myrtles as by a bonfire. Other features of creation seemed as inflamed as I was. The fire provided, I reasoned, an interim direction. I made toward its light, and in a turn or two of the road came upon a church afire. Its roof and steeple were ablaze, but the body of the building was yet untouched. I left the horse and walked to the church and entered the door and walked down the aisle. I took the ring pouch from my pocket and placed it on the altar, and then stood there in the smoke and the garish light. Pieces of roof began falling about me, flaming. I am the groom waiting at the altar. I will burn myself down, I thought. Just then a man burst through the doors. His clothes were twisted on him, and he carried a quart liquor bottle with but an inch left glowing amber at the bottom. He said, "What are you doing here? Get out." Pride, I guess, made me say, "I happened by. I came in to see if I could be of help." "Well, get out," he said. I left the church with him, and we determined to try to save it, though he was drunk and I was half out of my mind. From a creek nearby, we carried what water we could in his liquor bottle. We'd squat by the creek, waiting for the bottle to glug full through its narrow neck, and then together we would walk to the church and throw the water on the fire a quart at a time, not so much in hope of putting it out as to be able to say, if asked, that we tried. When dawn came, the man and I stood with sooty faces, looking at a round black circle on the land. "Well, that's that. Everything's burned but the hinges and the doorknobs," the man said. "Yes," I said. "We did what we could." "Without a doubt," I said. "There's not a man that could lay blame on us for lack of effort." "No, not a man," I said. He shook the last drops of water out of his liquor bottle onto the singed grass at the edge of the fire ring and put it in his coat pocket and walked on up the road. I went to the horse and mounted and rode back into Charleston. A week later, I booked passage on a ship bound for England, and for the next year I did little but roam about examining old churches and old paintings. When I returned, I found that your mother had married the man I had seen her with on the porch. He was a Frenchman, an associate of her father's, a broker of wines. She had gone with him to live in France. It was like a door closed. I'd always been drawn to matters of the spirit, and so I withdrew from my duties in the family business and went into ministry with both resignation and glee. I've never for a moment regretted that decision. 19 years passed, and one spring day I discovered that Claire had returned from France alone. Her husband had died. It had been a childless marriage, and not entirely a pleasant one if gossip was to be believed. Bitter, in fact. The little Frenchman had lived up to my most selfish dreams. Within days of hearing this news, I returned to the warehouse on the Cooper and met again with Deschutes. He was now an old man, great of waist and flabby at the jowls, and I had a widow's peak and had grown gray at the temples. The look he gave me would serve perfectly as illustration of the word supercilious. He said, "How may I help you?" in a tone that some previous time might have led to seconds and pistols. I said, "We're going to go at this thing again, and this time I intend to see that it sticks." That autumn, your mother and I married, and for 2 years I was as happy as a man can be, and I think I made her happy as well. Her previous husband, the little Frenchman, had been unsatisfactory in every regard. He blamed her for the lack of children and grew sour and harsh. I made it my business to reimburse her for every slight, every meanness. The months when we knew you were to come seemed a strange blessing for a pair such as we were, old and marred by the past. When Claire died in childbirth, I could not hardly think that God would be so short with us. I could do little for weeks. Kind neighbors found a wet nurse for you, and I took to my bed. When I arose again, it was with the determination that my life was now at your service. When her father's story was done, Ada had stood and walked behind his chair, and stroked his hair back from his brow and kissed him on the crown of his head. She knew not what to say. She was so taken aback by this tale of her creation. She could not at that moment easily frame herself anew, not as some staid erratum, but as the product of passion extended against great odds. By the time Ada's story was done, full dark had almost fallen, and a hazy moon stood above a bank of clouds to the east. The dark shape of a high bird passed across the face of the moon, then another, and then more and more in fleet chords, some night-flying race of grebe or snipe, maybe, in passage south. The stars as yet were not out, but to the west two planets, bright beacons in the indigo sky, neared setting behind a trailing flange of cold mountain. "The blue one, that brighter one, is Venus," Ada said, as she and Ruby turned up the road to Black Cove. To Live Like a Gamecock. Midday, Inman Vizi came upon a new sawn tree, a fair-sized hickory, felled parallel to the track they walked. Beside it lay a long cross-cut saw, its blade oiled and entirely free of rust, all the intricate teeth of its cutting edge bright from recent sharpening. "Looky there," Vizi said, "an abandoned saw. Somebody'd give me a pretty penny for that." He went to pick it up, and Inman said, "The woodcutters have just gone to get their dinners. They're shortly coming back to buck and split this hickory." "Well, I don't know any such thing," Vizi said, "other than that there's a saw by the road, and I found it." Vizi picked it up and balanced the length of it across his shoulder and walked on. At every step, the wood handles at either end bounced, and the big blade hummed and sproinged like the music of a jew's harp. "I'll sell this off to the first man we meet," he said. "You seem mighty free and easy with the property of others. I'd like to hear how you squared that up with gospel in your sermons," Inman said. "Well, make no mistake about it. On the issue of property, God is none too particular. His respect for it is not great, a prejudice he demonstrates at every turn. Note especially the way he uses fire and flood. Have you ever seen a pattern of justice in their application?" "No," said Inman, "not that you'd notice." "Exactly. All I can say is that a man who aims to model himself on the deity can't put too much thinking into who a particular saw belongs to. Such things distract you from the grand view." "The grand view," Inman said. He looked at the preacher's scabby pate, the thin cut under his eye from the big whore, and the mark still there from the pistol stroke Inman had given him by the deep river. "You're a one to be talking to the grand view with the whippings you've taken," he said. "Every one of them just at that." "I'm not saying I didn't need whipping," Beezy said, "and many a better man has taken a worse one, but I don't aim to take another lightly." That thought turned Beezy's mind to matters of defense, and he said, "Let me see that mighty pistol of yours." "No," said Inman. "Come on, I won't hurt it." "No. All I was thinking was that it would be just the armature for a pistolier." "Too big and heavy," Inman said. "You need a navy pistol, a Colt's, or a Star. It's the right heft for drawing out fast." "I'd at least like mine back," Vizi said. "I plan to hold it until we part ways," Inman said. "That might come unexpected," Vizi said, "and then I'd be left weaponless." "And the world a better place for it," Inman said. They presently walked under an enormous honey locust tree that leaned over the road. Lacking better victuals, they stopped and filled their pockets with its long, rusty pods. They journeyed on, splitting the pods with their thumbnails and eating out the sweet white pulp by scraping it against their teeth. After a time, they spied a man standing off below the road, seemingly in deep contemplation over the scene before him, the chief feature of which was a great black bull dead in the fork of a creek. The man saw them passing by and hailed them, asking if two such sports might come down from the road and give a hand. Inman climbed down, Vizi set his saw by the roadside and followed. They stood beside the man and looked at the swollen bull, branch water lapping against its belly, flies in clouds about its mouth and ass. They all had their arms crossed, eyes downcast, the posture of workers faced with a job they don't want to have to do. The man was not precisely old, but he was working his way there. Thick through the barrel as virile males of most mammal species from ape to horse will get in their late maturity. He wore a hat, a black wool relic with a sugar-loaf crown. Though the day was not much cold, he had tied the broad brim down around his ears with a piece of sisal until it fit about his head like a bonnet. Great bushy burnsides furzed out to his jawbone, and he peered from under the hat's brim with dark eyes, the lid swollen and hooded as a raptor's. He had a little round mouth that reminded Inman of the blowhole on an enormous snouted fish he had seen during a brief spell of fighting along the coast back near the war's start. Propped against a nearby tree was a single-barrel 10-gauge shotgun. The barrel looked to have been sawed off somewhat short to throw a pattern wider than was either common or practical. The job had been done with insufficient tools, for the muzzle was ragged and not entirely square to the barrel, as if cut on the bias. "How do you aim to get it out?" Veazey said. The man paused before answering and formed pinchers with thumb and forefinger, then went investigating under his pants for some minute creature troubling his groin. He pulled out his pinchers and held them close to his eyes and seemed to crack something between his thick yellow nails. His hands were large, and the skin of them had a chalky scurf to it. The bull, he explained, had wandered off days earlier and died of some unknown disorder. The branch, he said, was their water source, and its normal neutral flavor had taken on a certain tart rankness that had sent him walking up its banks looking for the reason. He had a length of rope with him, and he reckoned they might all work together and snatch the bull from the water. Inman regarded the man and Veazey, and then he looked at the humped mass of the bull. It would take at least a team of draft horses to drag that bull out, he judged. "We could try to pull it out," he said, "but that's a big bull. We might better think of some other way." The man ignored him and tied onto the bull's neck, and they all took hold of the rope and heaved. The carcass moved not an inch. "Levers," the man said, "we can lever him out if we can find poles." "We don't have to find them. We can cut poles to suit," Veazey said. "I've got a good saw, which you might want to buy off me when we're done." He ran up the bank to get the crosscut. He was excited as a boy getting to do a job with men for the first time. Inman thought the idea a poor one, and so he sat on a downed log and watched with amusement as the two men set to work with great and misplaced enthusiasm. They reminded him of army engineers and their minions setting to build a bridge or the like, their eagerness all out of proportion to the actual worth of the thing they were working at, and the end result would be a whole lot of effort on a job that generally struck Inman as better off left undone. As Inman watched, Veazey and the man cut three stout poles. In short order they were up to their shanks in the water and had thrown big rocks in place to act as fulcrums. They worked in concert, trying to roll the bull over, but could get it to do little more than wiggle flabbily as they strained against the poles. Inman joined them, and this time it did move. Problem was, even with the pole ends pulled all the way down into the water, they could achieve only about a foot of lift. Then they would tire and let up on the poles, and the bull would fall back with a splash. "I know," Veazey said. "We can lever it up and then shove rocks under it with our feet to hold it. Then we lever it again from there with a higher fulcrum and add more rocks. We do it over and over, and by and by we get it rolled." Inman eyed the distance from the bull to dry ground. "We roll it over once and it'll still be in the water," he said. "Roll it twice then," Veazey said. "That will get it to the bank," Inman said, "but it'll still rot and run into the water." "Roll it thrice," Veazey said. He was consumed in all his parts by the wonder of the lever and the manly work of engineering. Inman could picture them there until dark, jacking up the bull and chalking it with rocks and jacking again, hour upon hour of good walking time or good resting time passing away. Inman went to the stream bank where Veazey had left the saw. He picked it up and returned to the bull and set the edge of the blade to its neck. "Somebody get on the other end," he said. Veazey looked sorely disappointed, but the man took the far handle, and in a few pulls they had the head off. Then soon after, a section of chest with the forelegs attached. The next cut separated hindquarters from belly. It opened up with a great flush of organs and dark fluid and a release of gas. Veazey watched, and then bent and vomited into the water. A spume of honey locust pulp floated away downstream. The man looked over and cackled as if a rare joke had been passed. "Weak in the stomach," he said. "He's a pulpiteer," Inman said. "This is some distance from his chosen work." When they were done with the sawing, the branch was strewn with bull parts, which they soon dragged out and left far aground. Still the water ran red, and it put Inman in mind of the creek at Sharpsburg. "I'd not drink that water for a few days yet," Inman said. "No," the man said, "I reckon not." The man and Inman rinsed their hands and forearms in the clear water upstream. "Come eat supper with us," the man said, "and we've a hayloft that's good for sleeping." "Only if you'll take that saw off our hands," Inman said to the man. "I expect $2 federal, 50 in state scrip," Veazey said, perking up. "Take it on," Inman said, "no fee." The man picked up the saw and balanced the midpoint across his shoulder, and with his free hand he took up the marred shotgun. Inman and Veazey went with him, walking on down the road, which followed the stream course. The man seemed lightened in his mood by having removed the bull from his drinking water, jocular, in fact. They had not walked far when he stopped and put a finger to his nose and winked. He went to a big oak with a hollow in its trunk at about eye level. He ran his arm up in the hole and drew out a stoppered brown bottle. "I've got a number of these secreted around for when I might feel the need," he said. They sat against the trunk of the tree and passed the bottle among them. The man said his name was Junior, and he set off on a tale of his young manhood, of his days traveling the cockfighting circuits. He told of one particular cock, a big dominicker, that lived for nothing but to fight and tread hens, of how it whipped everything thrown against it for months, of epic struggles, spectacular victories, in which the dominicker, looking to be facing certain defeat, would fly into the rafters of the barn the fight was held in, and roost there until all the spectators jeered. Then, when the jeering reached its zenith, it would drop like a hammer on the opposing bird, leaving a bright pile of blood and feathers in the dirt. Junior told also of how the women flung themselves at him in his travels, with about the vigor of the dominicker falling on his foe. One in particular that came to his mind was a married woman whose husband had invited him to stay with them for a few days between fights. She set her sights on him, rubbing against him at every chance. One day, when the husband was off plowing, she had gone out to dip water from the well. When she bent over to catch the bucket, Junior said he came up behind her and threw her skirts over her back. The way he told it, she was drawerless under the skirts, and he said she tipped her hind end up and stood on her toes. He had her right there, bent over the pit of the well. It lasted about as long as it took her to wind up a bucket of water, he said. When he was done, he went on down the road with his rooster under his arm. He led Inman and Veazey to believe that there had been a great number of such wonderful days in his earlier life. "I had my nose in the butter many a time," he said. Veazey thought this a fine story, for the liquor had run to his head, his stomach being empty. He whooped at its conclusion and jabbered on about how that was the life for a man. "To live like a gamecock, that is my target," he said in a wistful voice. Junior agreed that the roving life had been a fine one for him, and said that his troubles all began when he settled down and took a wife, for it came to pass that 3 years after the wedding she bore him a negro baby, and further she refused to name the father, denying Junior his just revenge. He set about instead to divorce her, but the judge had declined to grant one on the grounds that Junior knew she was a slut when he married her. She had later brought her two sisters to live with them, and they had proved her equals in harlotry, for one had borne twin boys of somewhat indeterminate race, and though they were now several years old, he could not put an exact figure to it, they had been raised with no more guidance than a pair of feral hogs, and neither the mother nor anyone else in the household had yet taken the trouble to name them, making reference to them singularly only by hooking a thumb in the direction of the intended boy and saying "Vatten." Junior claimed that the sum of his marital experience had caused him to believe that he should have married a 13-year-old and raised her to suit himself. As it was, he claimed to lie awake many a night, thinking that every moment till his death would be gloom, and that his only recourse would be to cut all their throats in their sleep, and then put the shotgun to his own head, or take to the woods and eventually be hunted down by dogs and treed and shot like a coon. This put something of a damper on Veazey's glee, and in a moment Junior returned the bottle to its place and took up the saw again. He led them down the road a bend or two to his house, which sat off below the road in a damp swale. It was a large structure, batten-sided, and in such poor repair that an end of it had fallen off the stacks of flat river stones that served for foundation. As a result, it stood tipped up, as if it were in the process of diving into the earth. The yard was littered with pyramidal gamecock dwellings made from unpeeled sticks tied together with honeysuckle vines. Inside, bright birds glared out the slots with cold, shiny eyes that saw the whole world as little other than opportunity for an adversary. Thin white smoke rose from the chimney, and a black pillar of smoke swelled skyward from some other source behind the house. As they left the road to descend into Junior's bottom land, a three-legged, patchy-haired dog of the terrier kind clambered out from under the porch and ran low to the ground and completely soundless on a trajectory straight to Inman, who had learned to heed a silent dog more than a barking dog. Before it got to him, Inman kicked and caught it under the chin with a boot toe. The dog collapsed and lay motionless in the dirt. Inman looked to Junior and said, "What was I to do?" "All are not thieves that dogs bark at," Veazey said. Junior just stood and looked. The dog eventually rose shakily onto its tripod, and in a series of vague tacking maneuvers made its way back under the porch. "I'm glad he's not dead," Inman said. "I don't give a shit one way or the other," Junior said. They walked on down to the house and into the kitchen and dining room. Junior immediately went to a pie safe and took out another bottle and 3 tin cups. The floor to the place was ramp-like in its tilt, and when Inman went to sit in a straight chair at the table, he had to clinch to the floor as best he could with his feet to keep from skidding with gravity to the low wall. In the chimney corner was a bedstead, and Inman could see that they had not even tried to shim it level, but had only made the modest effort of turning it so that the head was to the high side. There were pictures cut from books and newspapers hanging on the walls, but some were hung parallel to the cocked-up floor, some to a more abstract line that might have been arrived at with a spirit level. There was a fire smoldering in the fireplace and a Dutch oven sitting in the coals putting out a smell of rank meat cooking. The hearth was at such a rake that the smoke in its rise banked off the sidewall before finding the way up the chimney. With all one's expectations of the world's plumb line so thrown off, even pouring a dram of liquor from the bottle into a cup became a puzzler, and when Inman went to do it he missed the glass entirely and wet his shoe tops before he found the proper range and lead. When he had succeeded in filling the glass, he took a drink and reached to set the cup on the dinner table, and noted that little bumpers sawn from birch limbs had been nailed around each place at the table so that the plates and cups would not slide off the low side. Veezy walked around supping from his cup and looking at the place, trudging uphill and down. Then an idea struck him. "We could rig levers under the down end and soon set this thing right," he said. Levers seemed to have come to occupy the foreground of his thinking, as if he had discovered a machine that could be applied to all the puzzles that might be thrown at a person. Stick a lever under anything wrong and make it sit right and square to the world. "Well, I reckon we could lever it," Junior said. "But it's been this way so long we've got the hang of it now. It would seem queer to live in a place without a grade to it." They drank on a while, the liquor going fast to Inman's head, for he had eaten nothing but the pods since last evening's sparse supper. It hit Feezy's empty stomach harder, and he sat with his head cocked idly, looking down into his cup. Shortly a girl of 8 or 10 walked in the front door. She was a slight child, thin at ankle and shoulder bone. Her skin was the color of heavy cream, her hair brown, falling below her shoulders in crisp ringlets. Inman had seldom seen a prettier child. "Your mama here?" Junior said. "Yep," the girl said. "Where's she at?" Junior said. "Out back, was a minute ago." Veezy looked up from his cup and examined the child. He said to Junior, "Why, I've seen white children darker complected than that. What would you make her to be, octoroon or less?" "Octoroon or quadroon makes no difference. She's a niggeroon is all I can see," Junior said. Veezy suddenly stood and wove his way to the bed. He lay down and passed out. "What's your name?" Emma asked the girl. "Lula," she said. "No, it ain't," Junior said. He turned to the girl and glared. "Say what it is," he said. "Mama says it's Lula," the girl said. "Well, it ain't. That's just the kind of cat house name your mama would come up with. But I do the naming here. Your name is Chastity." "Either makes a fine name, I'd say," Inman said. "No," said Junior. "My name throws the other one into the shade, for mine commemorates what a whore her mama is." He drank off what was left in his cup and said, "Come on." Without looking to see if Inman followed, he led Inman out onto the front porch and sat in a rocker. Inman walked out in the yard and cast back his head to look at the sky. It was coming on evening, and the light was thin and slanting, and a portion of moon and the beacon of Venus stood in the eastern sky. The air was dry, and there was a chill in it, and Inman took a deep pull into his lungs, and the smell and feel of it brought a thought to his mind. "Fall's right now on me." What the air told was that the wheel of the year had turned yet another notch. "Lila," Junior called. In a minute a young woman came wandering around the corner of the house and sat on the porch steps directly between Inman and Junior. She drew her knees up high and examined Inman with a critical eye. She was a tow-headed, ample-haunched thing in a cotton dress so thin and bleached from washing that a man could very nearly see the texture of her skin through its parchment-colored fabric. The dress had once been a print of little flowers in files, but they had faded out till what was left looked more like characters, faint scribble from one of the vertical languages. The girl was, in all her lines, circular, and the lower halves of her pale thighs were on full display, where the dress hem fell back against the steps. Her eyes were the pale color of harebell blossoms. She went about with her head not combed. Her feet were bare and briar-scratched, and there was something about her that spoke of oddity so much that Inman found himself clearing his mind by adding up muddy toes on one of her round feet to check if the mystic five would indeed be the sum. Junior drew a cob pipe with a clay stem from his pocket, and with it a great wizened pouch of tobacco. He filled the pipe and thrust it into the hole of his mouth. He dangled the pouch for Inman to examine. "Bullsack," he said. "A man can't make a better pouch than God did. Such things are a test from God to see if we will make do with what he provides, or if we will shun dominion and seek improvement by our own weak devices." Then he addressed the girl. "Light," he said. She arose with a certain amount of disturbance and gaping of her dress skirt and went into the house and returned with a lit shuck. She bent over to fit the shuck to the pipe, and as she did, she presented her hind end to Inman. The thin dress gathered in the cleft of her buttocks and sheathed it over so tight he could see the cupped space and the muscle at the sides of her clenched ass and the twin dimples atop the place where her spine met her hip bones. All her underlying structure lay revealed before him, and Inman felt face to face with an alien visage, though not an entirely unfriendly one. But then the girl twisted and squealed out like a rabbit at the end of an owl's stoop, and Inman could see Junior's pinched fingers retreating from the vicinity of her bosom. "Junior, goddammit," she said. Lila returned to her seat on the steps and sat with a forearm pressed tight against her breast, and Junior smoked a while, and then Lila moved her arm, and there was a tiny spot of black blood soaked up into the cloth at the front of her dress. Junior said, "Get these bitches to feed you. I got a mare to check on down in the lower pasture." He rose and went to the edge of the porch and dug in his breeches and then pissed in a thick arc onto a snowball bush. He shook himself off, repacked, and walked out into the yard and on down the dimming road, still smoking and singing a tune around the pipe stem. The words of it that Inman heard were, "God gave Noah the rainbow sign, not no water, but the fire next time." Inman followed Lila around the house, outbuildings, smokehouse, can house, spring house, hen house, corn crib, bordered a space of packed earth like a courtyard. In the center of it was a fire of great logs. It flicked up high as Lila's head and threw sparks higher yet. The night was collecting itself and shading black at the edges of trees beyond the weedy gardens of corn and picked over beans in the middle distance. Nearby stood a kitchen garden enclosed by pails. Limp, dead crows stuck to the sharpened ends in various stages of rot. The yellow firelight reached out into the dark and threw crisp shadows against the walls of the unpainted buildings. The dome of sky directly overhead, though, was yet silvery and unmarked by stars. "Hey," Lila called. From the smokehouse came two pale females, the obvious sister of Lila, for they resembled her in sufficient particulars so that they might have been triplets. And then from the spring house a pair of dark-headed boy children emerged. They all gathered about the fire, and Lila said, "Supper done?" Nobody said anything, and one of the sisters stuck a rusty forefinger into the loop at the neck of a stoppered earthenware jug and lifted it from the ground near the fire. She balanced it on the crook of her arm and took a deep and resonant swig. She passed it along, and when it got to Inman he expected some foul homebrew, but the flavor of it matched up with no known liquor. It tasted like rich earth and something else, some potent extract blended from tree fungus and animal gland, with medicinal properties known to few. The jug went around a number of times. One of the sisters backed up to the fire and hiked up the tail of her dress and bent over and thrust out her scut to it and stared at Inman with a look of glazed pleasure in her blue eyes. Her breasts hung round and pendulous as if to crack open her thin bodice. He wondered what sort of house of sluts he had stumbled into. The third sister stood a minute, cupping a hand to her groin and looking off across the cornfield, and then she went into the smokehouse and came back with a wood-tined rake. She raked in the ashes at the edges of the fire and began turning up charred bundles of corn husks. The pair of boys seemed momentarily engaged. They looked on, and one of them walked over to the pile and said, "Doughboy, dough," in a flat voice. Otherwise, the children appeared to Inman stunned. They were hollow-eyed, and they moved about in the firelight of the courtyard, hant-like and wordless. They paced about the glaring yard in what seemed to be designs repeated over and over, rubbed into the earth with the shuffle of their footsteps. When Inman spoke to them, they neither answered nor flickered an eye in his direction to even acknowledge the sound of his voice, and he began to assume that what